Missouri, had been in an automobile accident in Harrisburg. I am here essentially reading all that's beneath the last section called Who Should Baptize. He was confined to bed with a broken leg at the time, and I consulted him. It was a problem neither of us had been confronted with before. Out here in Oregon, where there had been no resident minister, who should do the baptizing? And it was agreed that the person who was responsible for speaking, as Philip, a deacon, was used of God, should be at least responsible for baptizing. So he baptized them. This brought stern criticism from authorities higher up in the church. There were criticisms because the conference paid expenses when I was not considered a member of the Church of God Seventh-day General Conference centered in Stanbury, Missouri. And at this point, you remember, he was asked to speak before he was an ordained minister. He baptized the first converts before he was ordained in 1931, because I have gone back to the time of the meeting that was held in 1930, November, in which the Oregon Conference was organized, and then they asked him to speak publicly before his ordination, and then there were some people who were baptized. The work of the Oregon Conference was beginning, and it was done through a man who had not yet been baptized, which baptism did not occur until June of 1931. Just want you to know the background. Page 426, paragraph 3. Some of my comments might surprise you because you can read through and not necessarily understand the time sequence. Ordained Christ Minister is a subhead. I had come to see at a certain meeting a number of things that Mr. Armstrong then describes. I won't go through all of the details, but Mr. Armstrong was earning a living by himself. That's the important thing. 1931, he was earning a living. 426, paragraph 3, tells us about his job. The bottom of 426, on to 427, said, "It was decided by the officers of the Oregon Conference on the next all-day meeting that I would be ordained." This was June 1931. Paragraph 2, page 426, tells you about that ordination in June 1931. After he had in fact been preaching a great deal of time for 3.5 years. So Mr. Armstrong was asked to write since 28 and to begin to speak shortly after that. And he was both writing and speaking from 1928 to the middle of 1931. And the officers of the Oregon Conference on that all-day meeting decided that he should be ordained. Now, that ordination I've already alluded to in 1931 because he put earlier the names of the people who were president of this conference who had signed the second certificate. That's why that happens to be early in the sequence. I mentioned that because that's 1932, and that was plugged in there in order to show who was in charge of the Oregon Conference. So they clearly then accepted his membership as a converted person contributing to the church, and in accepting ordination, he accepted the reality that he had membership in the Oregon Conference, and in fact, he had been assigned to a responsibility to carry out the work of the Oregon Conference. I shall never forget that moment of my ordination. That's the top of 427. That's the first paragraph. one sentence, as one may well understand. In moving along, I go to paragraph 7. Let it be made plain here. 427, paragraph 7. I was ordained by and under the authority of the Oregon Conference of the Church of God, separately incorporated, not by the Stanbury, Missouri headquarters. And of course, that you should bear in mind, because this was where the membership of the church came to be interested more and more in, shall we call it, evangelizing the area in which they lived. These people, by the way, were recent comers to Oregon. Many of these had come from the Midwest, Oklahoma, and Missouri. In fact, I don't remember that I could identify how many of these people had lived that long in Oregon, because when I met them many years later, most of them had in fact come at the time. Many later had come too, but many of these people had come in comparatively recent times. The Great Dust Bowl had yet to occur, or was already beginning by 1931. So Mr. Armstrong was under the authority of the Oregon Conference of the Church of God, separately incorporated. It was affiliated with the General Conference centered in Stanbury, Missouri, which was the headquarters of the church as a whole. That's a very important section there, page 427, paragraph 7. I move along to page 437, paragraph 3. It was planned that I was to leave Eugene and put a campaign up at St. Helens, Oregon, with a minister by the name of Roy Daly, who had just returned from Stanbury and other points in the Midwest. The conference had just employed him. Now there were three of us on the payroll at $20 per week. At this rate, the conference treasury was soon going to be empty. This was the time, if you please, when $20 went a long way. Think about how far it would go today. Roy Daly, Herbert W. Armstrong, Elder Taylor were three individuals who were employed by the Oregon Conference. That's defined on page 437, paragraph 3. The end of the chapter, of course, is that page. So we now know that Mr. Armstrong was on salary from the Oregon Conference. That's where the tithes were sent. The conference, in addition, sent a certain sum to headquarters in Stanbury, Missouri. On page, we'll move along here, 443 to 444. These three men worked together. About 2 weeks after a number of meetings were being held at a place called Umapine, a letter from Mrs. Florence Curtis, Secretary of the State Conference of Oregon, informed us that the business meeting of the board had been called for only 2 or 3 days after our receipt of the letter. So the three men essentially came to separate from one another in terms of the way they went, for the simple reason that it was quite apparent that the General Conference Board could no longer afford to maintain three salaries. Elder Taylor was retained, the others were not. So Herbert Armstrong was no longer on salary. 444, I will read the 8th paragraph. As it turned out, the special business meeting was called off. Mr. Daly had raced back to the valley, that's the Willamette Valley. But just as he had anticipated, even though the board meeting was called off, he and I were laid off and Elder Taylor was kept on. Roy Daly hoped he could keep all three, or at least himself, on. But Mr. Armstrong completed the campaign. We will now move. We're not dealing with the details of how the work grew so much as to see the administrative background. I will move now to page 470. The top of the page. It was not until February 1933 that my prayers to be relieved of a newspaper responsibility occurred, that were fulfilled, and he was allowed to return to God's ministry. He finished after he was terminated from employment, not because he wasn't a minister. He was terminated from financial employment, but finished the campaign, and then he had to look for a living, and it was with the newspaper. So by February 1933, the Oregon Conference had accumulated sufficient money. So essentially, you had upwards of a year plus, part of 1931, the rest of 1932, in which he was unemployed by the church. The Depression had begun with October 1929, and these people, of course, were feeling it, as the country as a whole was. So Mr. Armstrong was re-employed. That's page 470, the top of the page. 482. Paragraph 1. One day late in February 1933, a farmer, Mike Helms, drove his pickup truck to our house. He had come to take us back to the valley. The church conference had now accumulated a small balance. This is all a part of 482. That's the page number in paragraph 1. The church conference had now accumulated a small balance. Mike Helms was president of the conference. He said he would be able to pay us $3 a week only. You remember, it started out at 20. Now in the Depression, and by the way, money was getting more and more valuable. As the Depression went on, money was more and more valuable. Not like some people who think that when the salary drops, money is less valuable. This $3 accomplished more than $3 would have, let's say, in 1931. Most people don't realize in a depression, money is more and more valuable. In inflation, money is less and less valuable. You thought you were getting rich when things were inflating. Well, if you had money in the Depression, you were getting richer. That is, if you had money. He said they would be able to pay us only $3 per week. The farmer brethren would supply us with vegetables, and members would buy other food for us, including beans. Somehow Mr. Armstrong never found beans his favorite vegetable. This is the re-employment of February 1933. They got back, in other words, into the work of the Oregon Conference. Now I will go to page 517. The story of the beginning of that Oregon Conference, the beginning of his publishing work and speaking work and ordination are past. Entering into the ministry as an employed minister, as distinct from being a minister and unemployed by the church, but employed by a business, is now the background that I'll take you through in 517. Paragraph 1. The very second time in my life I ever preached, if those early efforts could be called that, an opposing minister had appeared and devoted most of his sermon in an effort to tear down what I had preached in the first sermon. Another minister had tried to prevent my articles from appearing further in the Bible Advocate, the publishing organ of the Church of God. A plot had been hatched by two ministers during the Salem, Oregon meetings to discredit me and get me off the payroll of the Oregon Conference. So no sooner had he been on that now a new problem would arise in 1933. I will move to page 518. The opposition through the spring and summer of 1933, under the heading, the Pork Obsession, Pork, P-O-R-K, had come through two ministers who had moved up to Oregon from California, whose names I will not give. The argument was this: did every single person who was baptized have to know about and give up certain things before they could be... Sorry, that was incorrectly stated. That was what Mr. Armstrong, how he looked at it. The churches of God as a whole had operated under the premise that members should have learned certain things before they were baptized, one of which was that you should have learned all about unclean meats and understood that and obeyed, as if unclean meats could never be a temptation, before you could be baptized. Mr. Armstrong perceived that, in fact, they should avoid unclean meats, but that many people should learn about that later if they didn't already know, but that baptism shouldn't be delayed until they had learned all these things. And that became a controversy which was finally settled. But you sense a problem. Now, what is important here is that Mr. Armstrong cooperated with the Oregon Conference, even when there were debates concerning how to administer baptism, whether before or after you learned about unclean meats. They came to an agreement that the end result was essentially the same, and therefore there was no fundamental difference in the ultimate result in the brethren. Mr. Armstrong did not assume that because there was a difference in administration, he'd have to resign and start a competitive work, once you get the point. He recognized that it was possible to lay the cards on the table, and it was possible for the other ministers from headquarters, or that now had come from California and were at least representing the Oregon Conference, to discuss the matter. And they agreed that the end result was essentially the same, and so they could cooperate. Page 420 tells the story of further problems. I want to read the bottom of 420. I had not mentioned it before, but in April 1933, during the Salem meeting, I had started the issuing of a monthly bulletin for members of the conference. It was mimeographed. I had hired the bulletin printed at the local mimeograph shop, page 521, bottom of 520, top of 521. And so Mr. Armstrong here introduces for the Oregon Conference a bulletin. He was capable of publishing material. Others may not have seen the value of some kind of publication each month to tell of the work of the Oregon Conference of the Church of God Seventh Day. At the Fisher home where he was staying after starting the Fir Butte school meetings, I had borrowed a typewriter. The Eugene mimeograph dealer permitted me to use one of his mimeographs without charge, that I had to pay for the stencils, goes without saying, in the paper. These costs were paid by the Oregon Conference Treasury. So we have here the fact that there was a bulletin being published. There was no plain truth yet, you know. Now we move along to 524. Under the title, The Double Cross, 524. As soon as I had finished, Mr. Fisher's car was to arrive to take me back to the Fir Butte schoolhouse for the evening meeting. I was forced to leave immediately. Under the circumstances, in a meeting in which he was attending, I had asked board members and ministers if they would postpone any action I'm not going in the background of this. He happens to have been at a meeting. Half of the brethren present were very much on my side. As I left the church, this half rose and walked out to assure me of their sympathy, that they would resist any action against me. So there was this constant problem. Mr. Armstrong did not decide to leave merely because he felt he was under opposition within the conference, sometimes from people from the outside. I want you to know that picture. As soon as I and all who would support me had gone outside, Messrs. Ray and Oberg broke their word. That is, they had agreed to take no action at that time, since the members were going out to greet Mr. Armstrong goodbye. They immediately offered a resolution that I be required, if I remain in the conference, to baptize people in the way that they insisted with regard to pork, and it also even involved the question of smoking. And those remaining inside the church were swayed into voting for it. As soon as I heard of the action that they were going to require me, Mr. Armstrong is speaking and writing here, to teach people certain things that they must know before they have the power of the Holy Spirit always to resist temptation, he said, I immediately wrote a letter canceling the $3 per week salary, suggesting they give it to Messrs. Oberg and Ray. I did not resign from the conference, but I refused further salary. Page 524. That's at the bottom of the page. I have simply been reading all the way through, beginning with the subhead, the double cross. 525. As for me and my house, I then said firmly, we shall serve the eternal our God, and Him only shall we serve. If men pay us a salary, even as small as $3 per week, we have now learned we must preach only what men order us to preach. Now remember, the conference essentially was divided in half. There were those who saw it one way and those who saw it another. And it was an attempt on the part of one to force their will on the part of the other half. The conference did not break up the relationship between the two factions, shall we call it, in the Oregon Conference was not terminated. But Mr. Armstrong's salary was terminated by himself. It may seem like a small step to require great courage to give up a $3 a week income. But it really didn't require much courage. They had learned already the significance of faith. And in those days, probably as much was coming in the form of non-money as was coming in the form of money. This was the crossroads, a final pivotal crucial test before the living Christ began opening the doors of mass communication through which God's work would come to life after centuries of sleeping and go on to all the world, which he didn't dream of then, preparing the way for Christ's return to earth as ruler over all nations, a perspective that he didn't dream of to start with, and not for perhaps another decade. Anyway, this is the story in which the Oregon Conference was made up of ministers on salary and ministers not on, a minister not on salary, and brethren who were encouraging that a work be done more and more, and others who were in opposition to a work. And the interesting thing, this kind of opposition was moving along now for 3 years. 1931, 1932, 1933. So much for that background. Page 526, paragraphs 2 and 3. 526. Mrs. Armstrong and I continued to fellowship with the brethren. I continued to work with them. and with their ministers. As far as that was possible, the lay brethren looked to me for the leadership of getting the work going. But from that all-day wrangle, I was independent of them and their ministers, financially. From that time, I was dependent solely on God. We did not ask or solicit financial contributions from any except those who had voluntarily become financial co-workers with us and who had been and this has been the policy ever since, which is irrelevant to our story here. He did not send letters out to all the church trying to persuade them. He simply had those who were already supporting the work of the Oregon Conference that God had been developing through him and through others at the same time, but usually the fruit was born when he was alone, and it was much more difficult to see what was happening in any positive results when he was working with the others. Now, I will move along from page 526, paragraphs 2 and 3. Paragraph 3 I won't read, but it tells you here of the gradual growth of the work over time. But we will now move to 529, paragraph 5. In October 1, 1933, the bulletin carried the report that more than 20 signified their desire to establish a new Sabbath-keeping church in the area where a family had been living, the Fishers. So the bulletin was continuing to be published that Mr. Armstrong had encouraged, just so you have the background there, 533, that's the page number, a surprising response, 533 to the end of 534, is the story of getting on radio by invitation. I will not read the details, but I want you at least to know the background. That Mr. Armstrong got on radio by invitation, and he was among other speakers. He got on there primarily because there were people who weren't showing up. Of other, let's say, groups of people or denominations. On October 21st, this is page 533, paragraph 7. At the home of Mr. and Mrs. Ed Smith, the man who couldn't afford to tithe, if you remember that article, just across the road from the Jeans School, which has been moved since, and I saw it last year, it's cut in two, and it's a private residence, 4 miles west of Fairbute, a new Church of God was organized with Mr. Fisher as deacon and myself as pastor. Meetings continued 3 times a week. These new members and lay brethren of the Oregon Conference all approved it joyfully as an effective evangelistic activity of the church. In other words, the brethren, half of the Oregon Conference that was alive and had been asleep, now had awakened to a responsibility of the church. Those who were awakened to what was going on, who had essentially lost contact, tended to be in opposition. And those who had insight into what God was beginning to do through the Oregon Conference supported a continued work and the plan for a radio broadcast. So I sent out a letter to the small mailing list. When Mr. Armstrong saw what radio could do, then they were planning for just such an opportunity. The cost of a radio broadcast would be $2.50 each time. That might seem strange today. It's incomprehensible what has happened to our money. Anyway, that was to begin in the beginning, January 1934. Now, page 555. As you can tell, we're nearing the conclusion. There are only so many pages, 646. 555. The bottom of this page, paragraph 4. During these late winter and spring months of 1934, the opposition of Elders Ray and Olberg did not cease. That's the other half of the Oregon Conference. I had rejected receiving the further $3 weekly salary from the Oregon Conference after the all-day wrangle in early August 1933. But this did not appease them. At a biennial general conference meeting of the church at Stanbury, Missouri, which probably was held in August, he does not remember, A.N. Duggar had lost his control, and the Church of God Seventh Day, centered at Stanbury, Missouri, split over the question of government. And Mr. Duggar essentially went to Salem, West Virginia, and that was the Salem branch, and the other branch of the General Conference stayed centered in Stanbury, Missouri. So I want you to note that the lively branch of the church was the Oregon Conference branch, and the headquarters itself had split by August of 1933. I will not go into those details, but in any case, A.N. Duggar accepted Mr. Armstrong as one of the ministers. There were to be 70 of them. He thought numbers were important. There were to be 7 deacons, 12 apostles, notice the order, and there were 70 others. Noting that I'll skip that. Anyway, on page 557, Mr. Duggar devised a board of 7 to handle the business of the church, making himself chairman. He knew that whoever controlled the purse strings controlled the church, whether he was a deacon and the others were apostles or not. Mr. Duggar's board of 7 handled all church income and finances for the eastern half, centered in Salem, West Virginia. But eastern half is the wrong way to put it, because it was the eastern half of the country, but he had people in support of him from Oregon to West Virginia. And the others were also scattered across the country. It carried all the real power to govern. Mr. Duggar had control over the salary of the 12. The word business appeared in the King James Version, but in fact, it isn't just a question of money, it was duty, as Mr. Armstrong, quoting the RSV and Moffat, has. There are many other duties a deacon has than merely handling the finances. So we had a situation here where, indeed, there were 2 factions now in the Oregon Conference. One loyal to Stanbury, which had incorporated as the Oregon Conference. I'm misreading that. One of them still loyal to Stanbury, as it was called. The other, which had incorporated as the Oregon Conference, being somewhat enamored of the new organization. That is, it would appear that a significant group of the Oregon Conference was also interested in Mr. Duggar's work in Salem. Mr. Duggar claimed world headquarters as Jerusalem, Palestine, United States headquarters in Salem, West Virginia. Mr. Armstrong made comments about it. He cooperated primarily with Mr. Duggar, because Mr. Duggar was the one who had initially allowed Mr. Armstrong's material to be published in the Bible Advocate. And Mr. Armstrong was not about to take sides between the two groups. Mr. Duggar was always the more favorable to Mr. Armstrong, just perhaps out of his own educational background and experience. Messrs. Olberg and Ray, page 558, paragraph 2. Made every effort to urge the Oregon Conference to go with Salem. One of the basic doctrinal points of the Salem organization was abstaining from pork and observing rigidly the laws of clean and unclean, to the point, you see, that you had to know all this before you were baptized. They are considered even today, and I visited Salem, West Virginia also, the more strict of the two. Mr. Fisher and Mr. Ellis and other members at Jean's and I decided we would simply leave the answer in God's hands as to what should happen with respect to the Oregon Conference. If the Salem reorganization accepted me as one of the 70, in spite of opposition of Oberg and Ray, we would go with it. We would go in. Otherwise, we would remain independent. That is, Mr. Armstrong was willing to say that if they accepted him, even if there was opposition in the conference, he would be willing to continue to work. And indeed, they did accept, and Mr. Armstrong did regularly work with them. 34, 35, 36. 19, this is the depth of the depression. Page 561, the center. This is under the new heading, Cooperating, Not Joining. We of the Church of God, meeting at the Jean Schoolhouse, along with the brethren of the Oregon Conference, decided to go along with it in cooperation. But we of the new local church near Eugene did not join in the sense of becoming an integral part. That is, those congregations that Mr. Armstrong specifically raised up remained essentially in cooperation, whereas those of the Oregon Conference, including people who were supporting Mr. Armstrong, essentially went in as participants of the new organization representing the Oregon Conference, of course, and working especially with Salem, West Virginia. Later on, they got together again. Then they separated. That's unimportant to us. I began to send in regular ministers' reports. Next paragraph, page 561. This paragraph 6. But I did not accept salary or expense money from them. None in our local church put himself under their authority. We kept ourselves free to obey God as set forth in the Scriptures should any differences come up. And they did later come up. So what you had was people within the Oregon Conference wholly cooperative with one or the two groups, Salem or Stanberry, and those groups that Mr. Armstrong had raised up working side by side. They were beginning to expand the work of the broadcast and then of the magazine, which started in February 1934. It was, in fact, a church that was never fully organized. But since he was considered one of the 70, Mr. Armstrong did send in regular ministerial reports. 561, the center of the page. Now, I will move to page 632. On Sunday, May 2, 1937, the program of the three network stations was dedicated to high school students. By arrangements with the principal, the combined boys and girls glee clubs of that church furnished the musical portion of the program. The message was directed to high school students in their own language, titled Getting a Real Kick Out of Life. 632, this is paragraph 2. A special note was sent on the Monday preceding to principals of the High School of Oregon and Southwestern Washington, asking them to announce the program to students in assembly. About first week of July, another 6 weeks campaign was started in Eugene. The attendance was good. As usual, there were a number of converts. So Mr. Armstrong was beginning to move along, I'm dealing with 1937, in bringing the work of the church to the attention of the public, in the schools, on the radio, in print. Now there was a particular camp meeting. It was the last of our cooperation with Salem, West Virginia. The son of one of the so-called 12 apostles had informed me of a plot hatched at a meeting he attended with his father, in which the so-called leading ministers of the Salem group intended to use a camp meeting of which we at Eugene, Oregon were hosts to attempt to discredit and ruin the radio broadcast, which was the work of both the Oregon Conference and the other congregations Mr. Armstrong had raised up, over which he, in fact, was their specific pastor. He never assumed responsibility over the others unless the conference approved it, even though the brethren raised up by him or by others tended to meet together, as they did. You know, I even spoke to the congregation on Scravel Hill at Jefferson, Oregon, as late as the early 1950s, when cooperation continued. Bottom of page 632. I had announced the camp meeting over the air weeks ahead and invited all listeners to attend. Now what happened was this. They intended to discredit the radio broadcast and the work at the meeting in which the Eugene Church of God was host. The time had come when they agreed that they would not try to do this. Because Mr. Armstrong said, if you try this, I won't hold a camp meeting. And he was the one who made the decision as to whether there would be a camp meeting or not. So they agreed not to speak against the program. But there was still an undercurrent of bitterness. At a minister's meeting, this very apostle who had always appeared friendly to me moved himself willingly to give a Judas kiss. Now, in a meeting at this camp meeting where they said they would not do this, 1937, this minister, unnamed here, having the floor in pretended sympathy that dear Brother Armstrong had worked so hard and was so overworked that they decided to help me by relieving me of some of my burdens. Therefore, they had decided to appoint another of their ministers, one totally hostile to me, as the pastor of the church at Jefferson. One elder and one deacon of the Jefferson church and Mr. Armstrong raised up many of the members who were attending there. It was an older church, as well as the combined churches at Alvador Jean's and Eugene that met at Eugene. One elder and a deacon shocked that the Jefferson church, you see, was now to be put in the hands of another who was an enemy of the work at a camp meeting held by the Eugene Church of God. They were, in a sense, seditious in an attempt to destroy the work of the Eugene Church, under the subterfuge that Mr. Armstrong was overworked. They were shocked and thoroughly aroused at this so evident subterfuge and bit of deceitful hypocrisy as a plot to take over that church and thus rob the broadcast of its tithes and offerings, so much so that they resigned immediately from their responsibilities to the Oregon Conference. All of us at Eugene Church and half of the members at Jefferson severed all connection and effort to cooperate with those who had proved themselves willing to enter into the meeting of the Church of God and to try to destroy it by taking away the Radio Church of God, as it was called, the financial support at Jefferson. The church here had no more choice. Up to this time, after years, 1937, there had been this kind of cooperation. We are here at a critical point in time where, from within the Oregon Conference, people took advantage of the work that was being done and a camp meeting being held, and had themselves said they would not raise a question with respect to broadcast publishing or anything, and their intent was, in fact, to split the support of the work Now notice what was happening. That they themselves realize now that the time had come that you cannot continue to...